Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. As primaries around the country start to unfold, all eyes turn to what voters are doing. The Ohio Republican primary just revealed the ongoing influence of the former president on the outcome, and many are wondering how his endorsement of Ted Budd in the North Carolina Republican primary for U.S. Senate may impact the outcome later this month. With early voting underway for the May 17th primary, that will set the stage for this fall's election, and with several key races on the ballot, we're going to look into the various contests and candidates with four people who follow all of this very closely. Steve Harrison is WFAE's political reporter and co-host of our Inside Politics podcast. Good morning, Steve.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Will Wright is with us. He covers politics for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome, Will.
Good morning, Mike.
And we're also joined by two political scientists. Dr. Eric Heberlig is at UNC Charlotte, and Dr. Susan Roberts is at Davidson College. Welcome to you both. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning.
Good morning, Eric.
Good morning.
And let me begin with you, in fact. Let us start just for a moment in Ohio, where Donald Trump endorsed J.D. Vance, one of the Republican candidates in the Senate race there. Vance won that contest, and that win has been described as a testament to Donald Trump's ongoing influence among Republicans. But he won that primary with 32.2% of the Republican vote after spending $80 million in TV advertising for a primary. The other two Republicans in that race garnered 23.9% and 23.3% respectively, meaning that they had nearly 50% of the Republican vote. And on the Democratic side, Tim Ryan got almost 70% of the Democratic vote. What does that mean then for the general election for the fall? I've already heard some Democrats saying they're going after that 23.9% of the vote for the runner-up in the Republican side. What does that mean for the November election?
Well, I think it means that the Republicans had a lot of potential candidates that could have gone many different ways. I think that the key indicator of Trump's influence is that Vance was polling pretty low in the polls about a month ago. Trump made the endorsement and Vance surged ahead and won, you know, I wouldn't say really handily, but, you know, by a decisive amount. We've seen similar dynamics here when Trump endorsed Ted Budd. Ted Budd has surged to a pretty solid lead in most recent polls. So I think it's an indicator of the fact that when you have lots of Republican candidates, they're all conservative. Most of them are taking the feisty, confrontational, Trumpian approach to politics. There's not a whole lot for Republican primary voters to differentiate one from another. So when Trump comes in and says, this is the candidate, well, if they're all good for you, why not go with the one that Trump supports?
So I guess, Susan.
So I would see this as a precursor to North Carolina's election.
So I guess, Susan, the question becomes, there is a subset, a large subset of Republican voters who are always Trumpers, and they will go with the candidate that Trump endorses or the one that toes the line most closely to Donald Trump. But then they have to face election in the general election. Is that subset of Republican voters in most states, and certainly here in North Carolina, enough to put them over the top?
Well, I think if you look at Ohio, Pennsylvania, Georgia, they have celebrity candidates. So North Carolina could be a real test of Trumpism and not celebrity. And so I think that that's where we look and say, this could be a test. And as Eric pointed out, J.D. Vance jumped 20 percentage points with that endorsement. Ted Budd is no celebrity. So that's going to be a real test. I think that subset of voters are going to turn out. Are they necessarily going to be pro-life voters? Not so clear.
Will, she just said that Ted Budd's not so famous in North Carolina. And in fact, he has jumped ahead of Pat McCrory, who, my God, after seven terms as Charlotte mayor and a term as governor, most North Carolinians have certainly heard his name or seen his face on television. What does that tell you, that the Trump endorsement has eclipsed Pat McCrory at the moment in the polls?
I think it tells you a lot. Yeah, like you said, I mean, you know, Ted Budd on a campaign trail, I mean, he'll hit on issues that matter to primary Republican voters, like critical race, inflation, economic issues. But you do have to wonder, where would he be without the Trump endorsement? And also without the amount of money the Club for Growth is spending on his campaign. They want to spend $14 million in this primary. And, you know, every candidate, including McCrory, has PACs supporting him, but not to that extent.
Yeah.
Not that much money. So that makes a big difference as well.
So Steve, and, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, you know, kind of on what Will said, I mean, the Trump endorsement has meant so much to Ted Budd that he's run his primary campaign. He did no debates. You know, they felt like they didn't need to. Why put yourself on the stage with the other candidates when they feel like they have the Trump card, you know, the president, former president's endorsement? So it's just kind of fascinating that they ran a totally alternative campaign, and it looks like it's going to work.
So if the breakdown of votes in North were similar in North Carolina to what happened in Ohio in that primary there, what would that mean for the fall here, Susan? That would put Ted Budd up against Sherry Beasley, correct?
Sure. And let me just mention this. I mean, for North Carolina, it's had unprecedented growth, younger people, growth and unaffiliated. They don't have much of a memory as Pat McCrory as mayor. If they remember Pat McCrory, it's Pat McCrory as governor, and that things didn't go well. I think that if you look at what's going to happen in terms of Sherry Beasley, and let's say it's Budd, I think it's going to be easier for Budd to, for lack of a better word, to pile on Sherry Beasley because of the abortion issue, where you wouldn't be able to do that easily if it was Budd versus a Black African-American woman.
Sherry Beasley is going to be the shoo-in. She's going to win the Democratic primary. There's no question about that, although there are other candidates. Does it really matter? I'm not sure who to ask this of. Eric, does it really matter who, which Republican she runs against in the general?
Oh, sure. You know, Pat McCrory has won a governor's race. He has won a statewide race. He does have a mayor's record of Charlotte, where he governed as a pragmatist that would give him the ability to have some crossover appeal. He pitches himself as an Eisenhower Republican, which I think he means to means he's more moderate. I'm not sure the average person knows, but the advantage of calling yourself that something no one knows what it is means that they can read into it whatever they want. Whereas Ted Budd is a more doctrinaire conservative, gives a more clear or polarizing contrast that perhaps Beasley can use to paint him as being too extreme.
Yeah.
And give her a chance even in a year that is trending against the Democrats.
Where are voters in North Carolina in terms of being on the political spectrum, Steve? Are they extremists to the left or extreme? I know they're not to the left, but extremists to the right or somewhere in the middle? Where are they, the majority?
Well, I think they're somewhere in the middle. But, you know, in North Carolina, Democrats haven't won a U.S. Senate race in 14 years. They come close, but Republicans hold kind of a small but durable edge. And at this point in time, the polling shows that so far, Ted Budd is the stronger candidate against Sherry Beasley. Now, the Democrats haven't attacked him yet. They haven't tried to paint him as an extremist, so that could change. But as of this point, more Republicans say they will support Budd over McCrory in a general election. So it's, you know, it's the Democrats' job to kind of change that and make Ted Budd, you know, paint a picture that he's unacceptable. But, you know, Republicans go into this race with a small but consistent advantage.
Will.
Yeah, Mike, I just wanted to point out, too, that one thing I've been thinking about is just in the general election, who can get voters more excited enough to go and vote? You know, the turnout in midterm elections tends to be fairly low. And that's one thing I think both Sherry Beasley probably especially Sherry Beasley and whoever wins the Republican nomination will have to do is get people, figure out some way to get people fired up enough to actually go vote.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because it seems to me, even though $14 million has been spent, at least on the Republican side, on television advertising in the primary, they spent $80 million in Ohio. And this race here, Will, seems to be pretty quiet. I mean, I've seen some TV commercials, but not many. As Steve pointed out, there were a couple of Republican debates at which Ted Budd did not appear, but not many. Why so quiet for a race that may help decide which party controls the United States Senate?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't exactly know. I mean, I get why from the Democratic side, it's relatively quiet, because they don't have to be loud right now.
Right.
I mean, they might want to be to get people as energized as they can, as early as they can. But with Beasley having, very little competition, she doesn't need to spend that kind of money. On the Republican side, I don't know. Maybe someone else has better insight.
And Susan, did you want to comment on that, Susan? Go ahead.
No, I mean, I was just saying that one of the key things for Sherry Beasley is if she can galvanize the women's vote, the Black vote, the Hispanic vote, and she's going to get a lot of money, not like the Club for Growth, but for Higher Heights, some other groups that support pro-choice, more liberal Black women candidates. And so that's not going to eclipse the Club for Growth, but it's going to be a factor. She's going to have some money, and she's not having to spend a dime now.
Well, something happened this week at the Supreme Court that may have handed the Democrats a great big gift with a sparkling bow on a silver tray. Because prior to this leak at the Supreme Court, it appeared that Republicans had an edge over Democrats in the midterms nationwide and had a very good chance of taking back the House and the Senate. And then this leak at the Supreme Court about a potential decision on overturning Roe v. Wade, it indicates that the court is quite open to overturning that after 50 years, and that has set off a firestorm. Women comprise more than half of the electorate. Could this upend this primary and the general election, Susan?
Well, let me preface this. I've studied access to abortion for 15 years, and this may be the thing that turns out a woman's vote, but not necessarily, because if you look at Hispanic voters, Catholic voters, Black voters, they don't necessarily vote pro-choice. And the activism, when I've studied more, it's been pro-life activism because they've been active. And so everyone that was shocked about this decision, I've been paying attention for years to this, and I think it might upend. Two questions I have, and one less important: who made the leak? That to me is one thing, but also why now? Why not in June, middle of June, when the decision comes out? I do not believe this is going to move. How embarrassing would it be for some of, and not just embarrassing, for some of the justices to move after the leak of this draft opinion? I don't think there's going to be any movement. If there were movement, to me, that might even indicate more polarization. The only way I think you could have movement is Justice Roberts, who loves precedent, who made a ruling that looked pro-choice on precedent in June of 2020. I don't think June of 2021, I don't think that that could move the vote. So I think the vote's going to stay, and the pro-life activism has been tremendously important.
And any move by the court at this point would look like more politicization of the court, which is a concern already because of this whole leaked report on their willingness to overturn Roe v. Wade. More about that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the primaries, which will be voted on in this state on May 17th, but early voting is underway. And we're talking about all this with Steve Harrison, our political reporter here at WFAE News. Will Wright is with us from the Charlotte Observer. He serves the same function there. Susan Roberts is with us, professor of political science at Davidson College, and Dr. Eric Heberling, professor of political science and public administration at UNC Charlotte. Eric, Republican voters have been working. We're kind of stuck on this abortion thing, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it because we're going to do a whole program on it on Monday. But Republicans have been working toward overturning Roe v. Wade forever. And I think a lot of mainstream Republicans paid lip service to it because they knew that the base wanted to hear that message, but really believed that it would never happen because there are political implications to it happening. And now the dog has caught the car. Now what?
Yeah, so if there are Republicans who in the legislatures who have privately believed that they had a safe vote and could vote for whatever anti-abortion measures would appeal to the base, yet would be bailed out with no policy implications because of the courts, now they're kind of stuck because they're publicly committed. They voted for very extreme anti-abortion measures and are going to have a hard time backtracking now to say, well, now that we can actually make this happen, I need to compromise and appeal to the middle. So I think Republicans are going to continue to push, aggressive anti-abortion measures. And it's really going to be up to party leaders to say, all right, well, we can't do the most extreme stuff. Yeah. We need to perhaps protect our majority. That's the only way you're going to get any type of moderation in Republican-controlled state legislatures.
Steve, national Republicans haven't really run on issues for a very long time. I know that the last presidential election cycle, the Republican Party had no platform because whatever Donald Trump wants, that's what we are for, was essentially their platform. But they've been fighting on fear and other things, but there are stances that they have taken, like their stance on abortion, their stance on providing health care to the needy, voting rights, and more seem to be at odds with what the majority of Americans, as polled, want out of their government. Why isn't that a recipe for disaster, running against majority whims and wishes?
Well, I think kind of Eric kind of said it well, that it was always this idea you could take positions, that the courts would bail you out. In this race, in our Senate race, Ted Budd has said he believes in no exceptions in terms of abortion, even for rape and incest. Pat McCrory has said that he supports that. I think I saw a poll that maybe about 51% of North Carolina voters would either want to keep abortion regulations as they are now or make them more liberal, easier to get. So that's an opening for Democrats. I think a lot of it kind of depends on the timing of this, when the decision comes down, if it comes down as we think it will, what the timing is in terms of the November election. I don't think that the difference between Pat McCrory and Ted Budd on abortion will matter at all in the May 17th primary. Now, this could come up in November.
When it comes, Susan, to the possible overturning of Roe v. Wade, a lot of people have seen this as another move toward minority rule in this country. We always already have this situation where a tiny amount of people have more senators than enormous amounts of people. When you take the four senators from North and South Dakota with their population and compare it to the two senators from the enormously populated California, it's way, way out of whack. And that is why the Senate seems to represent rural and less smaller population, more conservative population in the country at large. Now we have this idea that the Supreme Court, is being politicized. And if this draft turns out to be the final ruling, that does indicate, I would think, that Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett either prevaricated on their answers about Roe v. Wade at their hearings or lied about that. And that has made the Supreme Court a political tool. They were put there specifically to do what this might do. What do you say to that?
And first, I want to reemphasize what you said. The Republicans literally had no platform. I mean, they didn't just like figuratively have no platform, literally had no platform. I think if you look at it, 6 out of the 9 justices are Catholic. Most of the justices have the loyalty effect and they vote with the president who appointed them. And looking at the hearings, Amy Coney Barrett did say she tried to explain what a super precedent was. And both Gorsuch and Kavanaugh said it was settled law, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they would not amend it and make changes. So did they prevaricate? I don't think, did they, you know, obfuscate? I think so. And if you look at, you know, the case, people want to reform voting rights laws. People want to look at reforming the Electoral College. There's a lot going on.
So no matter which side you come down on, Eric, on this right to life issue, this is proof positive that elections matter. This happened because of elections and who people voted for. And the last president was a minority president in terms of the fact that he didn't win the popular vote. And yet he appointed 3 judges, justices to the Supreme Court. Do you think people understand that? Will that filter down to the primary, that your vote, even in a primary, matters?
Yeah, votes in primaries matter because that ends up with our 2 extreme choices in a general election. If more moderates showed up and voted in primaries, we'd have choices that more people felt better about in a general election. And I'd also say that election matter in terms of what Steve was talking about. You can have public opinion polls where a majority say they support abortion rights, but if they don't vote on that when they show up in the voting booth, if they vote on inflation or something else, well, then their opinion on abortion doesn't matter if they end up voting for an anti-abortion candidate. So we have lots of examples, as you were pointing out, where majority opinion doesn't translate into public policy because politicians tend to respond to the most intense preferences, which tend to come from their party's base, the people who are willing to knock on doors, make phone calls, make donations based on their opinions, and everybody else who's mushy and moderate who don't vote on those issues are going to have less of a say.
Will.
Yeah, I just want to say on elections mattering, one thing I'm curious about is whether this will bring new attention to state legislature races, where people pay attention to the presidential, U.S. Senate, Congress, but I don't know what percentage of people can name their North Carolina House rep. And now this is coming into, you know, those elections will matter probably more than they have in a long time, I would think, with this issue on the line. So I'm curious kind of how voters respond to that. Will they make that connection? How much more energy will be put into those campaigns?
Because you are right. If this goes through the way it appears to be going through, this will throw it back to the states. So the states will have authority over abortion and many other issues because state houses around the country on things like voting rights have been working very, particularly Republican controlled state houses, have been working very hard to have that issue go their way. Back to the primaries here. Oh, do you know which party will generally has the better turnout in primaries?
I believe Republicans. Is that right, Susan and Eric?
Yes.
I think you're right. Yeah.
And does it matter which party has the bigger turnout in a primary as opposed to a general?
I don't know about that.
Okay. All right.
I mean, to say that it matters in the sense, like what Eric said, you get a certain candidate, but I don't know if it translates to the general. Like if you see a bigger turnout in the primary, do you then see a bigger one in the general for that party? I'm not sure.
So when it comes to local, go ahead.
High turnout in primaries is really about which party has the more competitive primaries. So it's more a function of which races are on the ballot and which party has the more well-known candidates who have the ability to drive voters to the polls.
So when it comes to local races, there are almost too many to talk about today in this area, because in Mecklenburg we have the city council, county commission, sheriff, district attorney, among other contests. Gaston County's fielding candidates for their county board and sheriff, Lincoln, Iredell, Catawba, Cabarrus, Rowan, Union, Ensign, and Stanley counties also have county commission races, among others. For how many of these races will the outcome be decided in the primaries? Do we know?
Well, I think a significant number of local races are decided in the primaries. I mean, you look at, you know, city council and county commission here. We have two city council seats out of seven that are held by Republicans. And in the county commission, they're all Democrats. And, you know, at large, I think for both bodies, for at large, they're all Democrats. So, you know, a lot of stuff. I mean, the primary, I think you can make a good argument, is the election in a lot of those local races. Mm.
Are there any particular races then, Steve, that we should be paying attention to?
I think I was going to say, I'll get to that in a second, but wanted okay. to just talk a little bit. You talked about the state legislature races and how much importance the legislature has in terms of, I mean, abortion coming up will be a huge deal. Under the map that we have now, you know, Mecklenburg County has 5 state Senate seats, 13 House seats. I mean, there's almost zero races on NMEA. I mean, there's one Republican, there's one primary for state Senate on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, there's 2 House primaries because the map is really non-competitive. I mean, it's not drawn to really have any kind of competitive seats. So there's just nothing. I mean, there's really no, there are no state legislative races. But going back to what you said, I mean, I think the race that, you know, if we go extremely local, that Charlotte City Council at large race is the one that's getting the most attention because of the field, including, you know, former Mayor Patrick Cannon, who went to prison. That's just such a may not be a particularly consequential race, but a great talker, just yeah. high interest.
And getting back to this non-competitive nature of the legislative races, 20% of the General Assembly districts have failed to field a candidate in one party or the other because it's a foregone conclusion about which party will win those seats. Among the many House races, United States House races in this state is, and perhaps the most visible, is what's happening in the 11th district involving Madison Cawthorn. He has several Republican challengers. How unusual is that for an incumbent, or in this case, a first-term incumbent, Steve, to have so many challengers? And what obstacles do they pose to his reelection?
It is extremely unusual, but Madison Cawthorn is an extremely unusual congressman with just, of course, weekly, daily misdeeds and embarrassments. So that's why you've got 7 Republicans who've lined up to try and knock him off. All the establishment Republicans in North Carolina are behind the current state senator in the mountains, Chuck Edwards. And this will be, I mean, this race will be, I think every political reporter, every person kind of following this, like, you know, the Bud McCrory race will be the most important. Everyone will be checking their laptops yeah. in the 11th district to follow this.
Madison
Cawthorn has brought this on himself. And I think every day, the latest leak, the video leak, it's reprehensible. And I think that he kind of makes jokes about, oh, we were just joking around. And I think he's an embarrassment, or he's considered an embarrassment to the Republicans. And as Steve said, to the establishment.
What's happening to him and because of him is unprecedented, I think. He has been found trying to carry loaded guns onto airplanes. He's taken a knife into, I think, a school board meeting or a meeting at a school among individuals where knives are not allowed. He's been accused of, he has accused his colleagues of inviting him to drug-fueled orgies. He's called Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky a thug. He's posted pictures of himself, or pictures of himself have been posted, I don't know if he did it, wearing women's lingerie. And other ones, including a video that came out yesterday of what is purported to be simulated sex. Senator Tom Tillis has called for an investigation into the congressman for insider trading, and there is a group of people trying to get him barred from being able to be in the United States Congress using the 14th Amendment, which prohibits people who have participated in an insurrection from being a member of Congress. Any one of those things would have sunk anybody in politics 5, 10, 15 years ago. What does it say, Susan, about the state of our politics that all of these things have gone on, and he's still in the race.
Well, I think, you know, you look at some of the other races, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and where he's getting some being flashy, Josh Hawley, some of these others, it's getting a little more acceptable, but he doesn't have a record to run on. He has nothing to save him but his character, and that's not saving him. And I think he had a really kind of a Kleenex resume going into the race to begin with, and everything he's done has contributed to the image that he is the youngest serving member. And I think that how it's happened may be that people have gotten more tolerant. If you look back at other candidates that have, you know, what one consider a peccadillo, Cal Cunningham, it did sink him. But I think that this is so outlandish, and everything you mentioned, and in addition, you know, sexual harassment charges when he was a one semester undergraduate, I think it reaches a point that it's no longer acceptable. It's no longer casual.
Yeah. Eric.
Mike, I wouldn't reach a conclusion yet on whether we're tolerating this, because almost all of this information has come out since the last election. He was elected in a safe Republican district. There was some controversies when he ran the first time, but none of the stuff that you just listed was known when he was first elected. So this is his first confrontation with voters. And as Steve pointed out, there are a number of serious Republicans running against him. And voters and other politicians will tolerate all type of misbehavior from party leaders in their own behavior. This time we have a sitting U.S. senator who's actively campaigning against a member of his own party. This is extremely unusual. You have primary challengers. You don't have state senators running against incumbent members of Congress. So Cawthorn may still get, you know, over 30% of the vote and be willing to advance, just because all these the number of challengers will split the anti-Cawthorn vote. But I don't take any of this as evidence that people are okay with this.
There are a number of other House races that I want to get into that I don't have time to get into in the time remaining in this segment. I only have 30 seconds left. So let me bring in an email from Barry, who says, where can we get information on the candidates for district court judges? Anybody offer any? Will, can you tell us where they can go for information about that?
We have a voter guide where we have Q&As with district court judges, and you can go to charlotteobserver.com, click on the elections tab, and find Q&As with all your candidates there.
There you go. We'll take a break. We'll come back with more in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the primaries, which are the early voting for which is underway, and the primary itself will be held on May 17th. Susan Roberts is here from Davidson College, Eric Heberle from UNC Charlotte, Will Wright from the Charlotte Observer, and Steve Harrison from WFAE News. Steve, there are four U.S. House districts that cover the Charlotte metro area. I think that's right. The 8th, the 10th, the 12th, and the 14th. There's also a South Carolina race, that state's 5th district, which also impacts this region, because it's in York County. Tell us what you can in the time allotted for those races.
There are really no races. I mean, just to be blunt, because the map that was drawn by the special masters for the North Carolina Supreme Court created all of those four seats in North Carolina all very safe. Now, there's the one seat, the district that Jeff Jackson is running in on the Democratic side. There is a chance, if the Republicans have a huge wave year, that maybe they could take that seat. I think Biden won that seat by 11 percentage points last time. But if you go back to the Romney-Obama era, Obama won it by 3. So there's a lot of Republicans in that district that were kind of anti-Trump Republicans. Maybe somehow, you know, they will come back to the Republican Party. But overall, you know, Elman Adams' seat, Dan Bishop, Richard Hudson, not competitive.
Okay. Ordinary citizens don't pay a lot of attention to the redrawing of these district maps. It's mind numbing, but you do because that's your job. So how many people will be surprised when they walk into the voting booth and see a candidate who they didn't expect to see in a particular race because of the redrawing of these maps?
Yeah, I think maybe about half in Mecklenburg County. I mean, Alma Adams' district, I think people there know that she's running probably and have voted for her for a long time. I think they will be maybe surprised to see Jeff Jackson. You know, they may have known that he was running for U.S. Senate and then dropped out. He hasn't had a huge campaign for this House race because, you know, he's likely going to win it. So I think people might be surprised by seeing Jeff Jackson, especially in Gaston County, I would think. Yeah.
But there's also the fact that because these districts have been drawn, the candidate that you voted for last time that you might want to vote for again is no longer representing you because of the way the districts were drawn. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. So there are people who were in an old Adams district, for example, that are now going to be voting for either Jeff Jackson or the Republican primary there.
So let's move to city council. I know that Charlotte's just one part of this region, but Charlotte City Council has been dominated, I think, as you pointed out, Eric, by Democrats. There are only two Republicans currently serving on city council. But this year, you say, provides the GOP an opportunity, a chance that they haven't seen in years to win some seats. Why do you think that?
They've been aggressive in recruiting candidates. They have a full slate of candidates for the at-large seats. That's the first time in a number of election cycles that they've had that. So being in the game is really the first step to winning it. And as we've talked about, the Republicans have the wins at their backs in this election nationally. How much of a role that'll play at the local level is probably not very much, but it's some. The Republicans have also articulated a clear agenda related to crime and affordable housing. Certainly the affordable housing element has the potential to appeal to independent voters. Crime, of course, is an issue that always has a lot of emotional resonance at the local level. So, you know, with candidates in place and a strong Republican environment, you know, they have a chance. Well, and it does give Republican voters a reason to turn out for the primary in Mecklenburg County, which they haven't had in a number of election cycles.
Will.
Yeah, I just wanted to reiterate what Eric said, because I think their platform has been interesting. And basically, one of the things they're saying is, look, we've had Democratic control for how long, and affordable housing is still an issue. You know, crime is still an issue. They're basically sort of an anti-status quo platform. So I don't know. I just thought that's been an interesting tactic. I'll be curious to see how many people it pulls out.
Steve, Tariq Bakari, the Republican on council, Tariq Bakari, is largely responsible for putting together this slate of Republican challengers in the city council races. Who are they, and what do you see as their realistic chances?
I was going to say... that you're right. Tariq Bakari recruited almost all of them. And as Eric said, having a full slate is a good start. But the problem I'm seeing is kind of the second phase of a Republican getting elected is you have to raise a lot of money. I mean, I think $100,000 is kind of the minimum buy-in to win a citywide race. The last time I looked, kind of the best performing Republican candidate, Kyle Lukey, had raised $25,000. Two of the other candidates hadn't filed reports. They're just the people who have money in this city who would support Republican candidates haven't yet bought in that they can win. So it's still going to be a really, really uphill battle.
There are also some familiar faces of people who were on council who are now returning or trying to return to council, among them James Smudgy Mitchell, who was on council until very recently, and he quit because he took a job that was put him in conflict of interest with council business. He no longer has that job, so he's trying to come back. He's running again. Luana Mayfield, who represented District 3 for four terms who lost in a bid for an at-large seat in 2019, is in the race. But perhaps most intriguing candidate is in terms of how they may or may not be received, is former Charlotte Mayor Patrick Cannon. He was on council. He became the mayor. He was arrested while he was in office for taking bribes, and he went to prison for that. He says he has reformed and that people should forgive him. What's the buzz on him, Will? Are people willing to do that?
It's hard to say, Mike. Whenever he spoke at the in front of the Black Political Caucus, you know, he got a round of applause for saying that, saying, you know, God, something like God forgives, or you know, basically what you said, you know, the issue of I've reformed and I'm ready to get back at it. I was at a polling place on the day of early voting started, and a woman came out and said that of all things on the ballot, that's what she was surprised about, was Patrick Cannon. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people will have that response.
And he has, Susan, the endorsement of the Black Political Caucus. They endorsed several candidates. He's among them. In this era in which politicians seem to be composed entirely of Teflon, and when voters tend to excuse almost anything, will that filter down to Patrick Cannon? Can, will, should voters forgive him for tarnishing his name and that of the mayor's office?
Well, and one thing about Cannon, until knowing more about it, he had given some money, made a contribution to the Black Caucus. And then a few days later, he got their endorsement. Well, I guess he was contributing to a gala, and he wasn't buying an endorsement. But I think some of it will trickle down to the voters. And I think that name recognition, good or bad, and I think bad is one thing that might detract from his vote, it does go down to the voters. And I think they're going to have to decide about, sometimes you don't vote on issues, you vote on trust. Who do you trust? And is he going to be trustworthy? Because you can't anticipate what the issues are going to be. You can vote that way, the issue proximity, but you really sometimes have to vote on character. Hmm.
Steve, what about the Republican candidate's argument that you've had Democratic leadership for so long and you still have the problem with affordable housing? We still have a crime problem. Gun violence is very troubling at the moment. Are Mecklenburg County, are Charlotte City voters generally content with the direction that Democratic leaders on the county commission and Charlotte City Council and the mayor's office taken them? Or are they anxious and ready for change?
I think there's some anxiety that's in play. I don't think there's a lot of anxiety over affordable housing. There's some over crime, but you know, you have half anxiety, but then you have a lot of resignation. I mean, just the difficulty of winning a citywide race here. Now, if Patrick Cannon wins the primary, that would be a boost to Republican chances. That's someone you can run against. More money might come out to run a negative campaign. That would certainly give them a chance. But, you know, another problem is this general election is going to be in July. I mean, that is peak vacation time. A lot of people are going to be at the beach, especially a lot of Republicans are going to be at the beach. I mean, it's going to be really hard to let people know there's even an election. I mean, I don't think we've ever had a city election in July. So,
yeah, we should point out that the general election for House of Representatives, United States Senate, the legislature is in November, but the city council elections and the county commission elections, because they were delayed, are in July, and that's a big difference. You're very right about that. The Republicans who have said, see, you've had all these years of Democratic leadership, and we still have the affordable housing problem, we still have crime problems, have they put forth any proposals on how they would tackle those issues?
Probably, but it's hard to get policy messages through, and they're not the incumbent party, so they really don't need to. All they need to do is say that the people in charge are messing it up, give us a chance. And that's really the only message that's likely to get through.
The sheriff's office in Mecklenburg County and several other counties are among the races that people will be voting on. And in Mecklenburg, incumbent Gary McFadden has experienced some problems because of staffing issues and safety and morale at the county jail. He's had two challengers come forth. I think some federal or state regulatory board gave him 60 days to fix some problems, which I think he's fixed. I'm not sure. Your paper, Will, The Observer, chose not to endorse the incumbent Gary McFadden for re-election. They chose instead Gina Hicks. Why?
I believe they, I think it's what you related to, just all the problems that McFadden has been having with the jail. And, you know, Gina Hicks has a lot of experience in that office, in the sheriff's office. I think she's been there for something like 18 years. The other candidate, Marcus Robinson, has also been in law enforcement for, I think, over 2 decades. You know, so both candidates have that level of experience. I think Gina also, Gina Hicks also has some administrative experience as well that they thought would make her suited for being the sheriff.
Gary McFadden has extensive law enforcement. He spent his entire law enforcement, his entire career in law enforcement. He was a police officer. He was a detective. He had a television show about policing. Are the problems at the jail that we know about of his making? Are they political? Is it political opposition to some of the changes that he has tried to make in his time in that office? Is it just because he is the victim of what so many other businesses are, can't get people to work because everybody's quitting their jobs everywhere? What's the story there?
So the sheriff, right, the sheriff says that the problems at the jail are due to COVID and the Great Resignation. But there are other people, the people running against him, there are people inside the jail who say that no, that the sheriff had no management experience when he came to this job, which is true. And that a lot of the changes he made at the jail undermined staff morale, undermined discipline. And so, you know, this race, it's really interesting. I mean, it's a fascinating race. There was a debate that WBT hosted for the candidates that a week or so ago that was just so intense. I mean, the level of accusations against both candidates, it was at a whole nother level. So, yeah, in a way, this is a really important race and maybe the most interesting race in the county.
So who is the sheriff anywhere matters. Who the district attorney is anywhere matters, but they aren't generally as visible as candidates as some of the other people in and other office holders running for election. Eric, do you think people know, voters know enough about who these people are, what they do, and what they have or have not done?
No. Local races in general are really off most people's radar screens. But these critical issues, I think Steve's right that the sheriff's and the district attorney's races are really the more interesting and most consequential Democratic primary races on the ballot this time. And voters don't know a whole lot about them. But the fact that we do have competitive challengers who are getting some message out there, you know, it increases the chance that some voters are going to go in there with, you know, at least some vision of whether they want change or not in those offices.
And as an indication that you are right about that, Juan emails, why is Sherry Beasley the de facto winner of the Senate race in the Democratic primary? Isn't that undemocratic? Steve, why is she the de facto leader?
Well, because Jeff Jackson dropped out early this year. He was her, you know, considered her strongest competitor in terms of name recognition and fundraising. There are a lot of other Democrats on the ballot, but they have no money, no message. Was it good that Jeff Jackson dropped out? Would a competitive primary even better for Democrats? Maybe. You know, we would be talking about it more and there'd be more attention in the media. But there's just no one else on the ballot who has her experience and money.
So, Susan, I have 30 seconds left. Unfair question. In August of last year, the judicial panel struck down a 1973 North Carolina law barring felons from voting because it was largely affecting black voters, and it also stemmed from an era of white supremacy. Republican leaders are appealing that decision, which means felons will not be able to vote in these primaries. But they may be able to vote in the November election. In other parts of the country where felons can now vote, what has been the impact?
Well, I don't know what the impact has been, but I know that's changing in states as they become more conservative, and the Republicans are getting more or have more of those trifectas in which they control both chambers of the House and they control the governor's mansion. And I think that's going to be something to look at, and people don't look down ballot. And I think that's a problem.
If you want to know more about who's on the ballot and what races are important and who does what, when, where, and how, you can go to WFAE.org. We have a whole rundown there and at charlotteobserver.com. We'll write from The Observer, Steve Harrison from WFAE, Eric Heberlig, and Susan Roberts as well. Thank you. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.